neighbor had come out looking for her cat. He would never forget the look on Cynthia's face as he slithered out of that black Lincoln, feeling humiliated and furious. As he entered the front door with the girls, he didn't know if he could make it to the end of the hall and into the kitchen.
"Lord help!" cried Puny, looking shocked. "Go lay on the sofa this minute!"
He feebly obeyed. He had no choice. When the phone rang, he sat up, confused. Why was he on the sofa? His head throbbed wildly. It was nearly dark, with no lamp burning. He fumbled for the phone and knocked the handset to the floor. "Hold on, I'm coming," he shouted. He went to his knees, blindly searching the rug in front of the sofa. There. "Hello, sweetheart," he said, breathless.
"Why, Timothy!"
Edith Mallory gave a husky laugh.
"You must have been expecting someone special."
He was dumbfounded.
"I won't keep you. I've just come home to Mitford from Spain and heard the terrible thing that happened to you."
"The terrible thing didn't happen to me. It happened to Bill Sprouse," he said coldly.
"Of course. Well, do let me say, I hope you'll soon be well and strong, and that we'll be seeing you back to normal very quickly."
He heard her exhale smoke from her cigarette. His impulse was to fling the handset across the room. Yet he sat, speechless, enduring the pounding of his head.
"I must say, Timothy, that I hold no grudge against you, none at all. I ought to thank you. The people I might have rented the grill to have gone bankrupt, while Mr. Mosley's check arrives promptly every month."
"I must go," he said.
"Of course you must. I understand. Well then, goodbye."
He dropped the handset into his lap, feeling oddly alarmed, as if a viper now lay coiled in the darkened room. Hessie Mayhew awoke at 3 in the morning to the sound of... what in the dickens was it, anyway? Her vintage Sears box spring creaked as she sat up in bed and listened.
Hail!
The bedroom shimmered in a dazzling flash of light, and then came a crash of thunder that shook and rattled the windows. She clapped her hands over her eyes as if to deny this could be happening. Hail meant that every rose in her garden would be shattered. She'd be lucky to have a fistful left for the wedding at Methodist Chapel tomorrow. She'd be forced to rogue roses in other people's gardens from here to Wesley. And with a car that had tires so bald, Lou Boyd said she should start writing her obituary. Her mind was racing. Maybe Father Tim wouldn't mind if she cut what was left of his antique Malmaisons. For Pete's sake, he didn't even live at the rectory anymore. It was just that little bitty Frenchwoman and that cat the size of a barn. She would be glad to get rid of some of those roses. How many roses could one little woman use, anyway?
Father Tim,
Hessie gasped. His garden basket. Clad only in a faded toile pajama top she'd found at last year's Bane and Blessing, she bolted to the kitchen, switched on the light to the deck, and looked through the glass doors.
Mashed flat. Killed. Totaled. The beautiful basket with 12 herbs and 5 pots of miniature roses, lavender and sweet William, all so carefully nestled into living green moss, moss which she had pulled with her own hands from her own special section of her own backyard, a gesture she extended only to very special people, ruined. Hail the size of marbles jumped around on the deck and bounced against the glass doors. A blaze of lightning illumined her yard. She turned from the awful sight and stormed into the kitchen. She wouldn't wait till she was 65, thank you very much. She was getting out of the flower business immediately. Just as soon as she got new tires,
which two big weddings and a bridal luncheon would pay for, she was out of this racket. She couldn't bear another day of something as fragile, as frail, as puny as flowers. She would go to work at Walmart, maybe in the housewares section, or even at the front door, where she would give people a shopping cart and tell them to have a nice day. Completely disgusted and close to tears, she threw open the refrigerator door, snatched out last night's meatloaf, and gave herself permission to eat the whole thing. The sound of a hailstorm woke him from a deep sleep. He was lying on the sofa with something like a rock digging into his left rib. The blasted handset. He slammed it on the hook and dragged himself upstairs, where he found Barnabas under the bed and Violet curled on Cynthia's pillow. He looked at the clock, 3 in the morning, and not a word from New York. Should he call the hotel? Of course not. He wouldn't call anyone at such an hour. He sat in the wing chair, spent, though wakeful. He pulled the chain on the floor lamp next to him, and took what he called his upstairs Bible from the table. If he was going to find what he was seeking, he'd have to look. It was that simple. "Show me, Lord," he prayed aloud. "Lead me there, and open my heart to your wisdom." The Bible lay in his lap for a long time. He had no strength to open it. He climbed into bed and, lying on his back, listened to the clatter of hail on the roof and the baritone snore of his dog. He felt as if he'd gone back in time to his bachelor days, when the place beside him was always empty. But no, he wasn't that bachelor anymore. He'd been completely changed, altered clear to his taproot. He had a wife, and day after tomorrow she was coming home. Then they'd be up and doing, with a heart for any fate. He rolled onto his right side and punched up his pillow. He should have given Dooley another 20. Chapter 11. To Sing in the Dark. At 7 a.m., he snatched the ringing phone from the hook. "Cynthia? Timothy? Are you all right?" "Are you all right? That's the question." "We tried and tried to call, but the phone was busy for hours. Who on earth were you talking to?" "Nobody. I went to sleep on the sofa and must have rolled over on the receiver." "Pathetic. I can't leave you alone for 5 minutes." He heard the relief in her laughter. "I'm sorry, sweetheart. Forgive me. Was it wonderful? More than wonderful. Keep talking. I love the hard work, and the agony of hardly ever knowing if what I'm doing is any good, and then the joy of the book being published, and the children and parents liking it, and now, this. Are you 10 feet tall? Would you tower over your rustic husband? My humility has made me small enough to put in your pocket." "And how's Dooley treating his famous consort?" "He's taking the tenderest care of me, opening doors, even giving me his arm when we cross the street. You should see this, Timothy. I can't imagine who taught him such lovely, outmoded courtesy." "Heaven only knows." "And he tips 20%. They must have a class in that sort of thing at the university."
"I imagine so."
"And the flowers! Armloads of roses and tulips. But all from you, of course. Thank you, my darling. I can't wait to see you. How are you feeling?"
"Went out yesterday. Took the girls to Sweet Stuff. Got a haircut."
"Joe Ivy?"
"Brace yourself."
"Oh, dear. How did you feel being out and about? Was it all right?"
"I felt like a chick newly hatched from the shell."
"What are you up to today?" "I'm buying Dooley a suit."
"A suit?"
"Italian."
"Have mercy, Kavanaugh. He's only a youth."
"And a silk tie. He'll make the earth tremble when he walks."
He grinned. Dooley Barlow would never be the same.
The girls here absolutely fall over themselves when they see him. I can't think how Lace has held out so long.
Think how long I held out, he said, and look what happened.
I miss my husband, she said, suddenly pensive.
I miss my wife, my extravagant, generous, witty, and important wife.
I love it when you talk like that.
Ah, Kavanaugh, what don't you love?
Taxis that go 90 miles an hour in midtown traffic, pantyhose that are a size too small, which one can't know till dressing for the awards dinner, and then it's too late, and, of course, age spots.
He laughed. That about covers it.
We'll call you tonight and again in the morning, and before you know it, we'll be home.
I count the hours. When he waked this morning at 6, he'd felt leaden, old. Now that he'd heard her voice, he was fit for anything. Father?
George, come in.
Is this a good time? I was praying for you next door, and felt a strong conviction to do my praying over here instead. He opened the screen door to his tall, slender neighbor, known to all of Mitford as the man in the attic, and greeted him with a hug.
Glad to see you, brother. Have a seat. Tell me how things are going in your new hometown.
If I could tell you another time, Father, I've got 20 minutes to get to the bookstore.
Whatever you say.
Though 8 years in prison had added a few lines to George Gaynor's face, and his thinning hair had turned gray at the temples, Father Tim thought he'd never looked handsomer.
Father, I understand a little of what you've been through. I've been hesitant to ask you to let me pray for you.
No need to hesitate with me, George. We all need prayer.
He wished he could confess just how much indeed he needed it.
After giving Barnabas a ramble around Baxter Park, he poked through the hedge to the old rectory. The hail would have made hash of his roses and done a dandy job of hole-punching the hostas. He wasn't especially up for visiting the scene of the crime. He still felt fragile, like nearly transparent porcelain that might shatter if jostled. He knew only that he must get on with his life, which lately seemed to have passed him by.
Thanks be to God, his blood sugar had been down this morning. Things appeared nearly normal. He was right on the cusp of the prophesied 6 weeks. Soon, all would be well and very well.
Father, bonjour.
Helene Pringle stood on the back stoop waving. Her cat, Barbizon, sat by her feet, looking disgruntled.
Bonjour, Helene. I hope you don't mind me lurking around your backyard.
Indeed not, Father. It's your backyard. You may lurk whenever you please.
That was a terrific storm we had last night. I wanted to visit what was left of the roses.
Oh, my.
He looked at the leaves lying about and the rain of petals on the dark mulch.
Not much, I'm afraid.
My grandmother believed a bit of ill weather was good for the garden.
She came down the steps, tentative, yet smiling with some delight.
It's wonderful to see you out and about.
She wrung her hands as she spoke, as if greeting him gave her intense anxiety. He wondered if he might try to be more affable, in hopes of putting her at ease.
Thank you, Helene. I was beginning to ossify.
Ossify?
She said, perplexed. He smiled.
Harden like bone.
Oh, she said, oui.
He walked around the bed, trying to care about the devastation as fully as he might have cared a year or two ago. It took such energy to care.
Are you feeling all right, Father?
Oh, yes, pushing along.
He sat on the bench.
If you don't mind.
Certainly not. It's your bench, after all.
She stood on the opposite side of the bed, still wringing her hands. He realized there was nothing he could do.
I was in holding yesterday, and saw your dear boy.
Dooley?
Yes. He was coming out of the drugstore as I was going in. I don't go to Holding often. It seems such a journey.
Yes, it is a bit of a haul. But you couldn't have seen Dooley. He's in New York.
In New York?
She pondered this news, clearly befuddled.
But I spoke to him. Of course he didn't reply. He appeared to be in a great hurry, and awfully thin and pale.
She hesitated.
I wasn't going to say anything to you, but he was soiled and malhabile, quite unlike himself. I know he's living on a farm this summer. Perhaps that's why.
Yes, well, Dooley is in New York.
Oh, oui, bien sûr. You did say that. She shook her head. I suppose this boy did look younger than Dooley, yet how extraordinary.
He rose from the bench. I'll push off, Helene. Incidentally, the roast chicken you brought was very good indeed. Trey, he hesitated.
Bone.
Oui, Trey Bone. How hideous his French was. He had embarrassed himself and his neighbor into the bargain. Her cheeks flushed.
It was nothing.
Au revoir, then, he said, waving.
A bientôt, father. Thank you for coming. Please come again.
He shuffled home and sat on the sofa, panting. He should have the blasted sofa removed from the house, stored under lock and key, until things were a bit further along. His heart pounded.
Water, he said, as Puny came into the room.
You'll worry me to my grave, she said, looking distraught. She dashed to the kitchen and brought him a glass of water, which he drank down at once.
Good. Just what the doctor ordered.
Father?
Yes.
I couldn't stand it if anything happened to you.
Tears rolled heedlessly down her freckled cheeks.
Why, Puny, how amazing. I feel the very same way about you.
She laughed and wiped her eyes on her apron.
Are you all right?
I'm perfectly fine. It's true.
You ain't been yourself.
Who have I been, do you think? She giggled.
Somebody sad and grouchy.
Uh-huh.
She looked at him, wrinkling her brow. Cynthia loves you more than anything. She'd do anything for you. And so would I. And so would the girls. They love their grandpa.
Their grandpa loves them back.
You can't die, she said, matter-of-factly.
Certainly not.
Are you going to get back to your old self?
You bet.
Good, she said. I hope you make it snappy.
Dooley at the drugstore in Holding. It dawned on him as slowly as a sunrise, when it should have hit him like a bolt of lightning. He quickly punched the numbers on the handset and paced the floor.
Bonjour.
Helene, Tim Cavanaugh. I hope I haven't interrupted a lesson.
Not at all, Father. Two students are out today with summer colds. I don't have a lesson until 4:30.
Where is the drugstore in Holding?
There are two drugstores. I patronize the one on Main Street. It has a special hard candy mother enjoys.
He'd never been on Holding's Main Street. He'd always gone to the mall on the bypass, like the rest of the common horde.
Could you give me directions? It's awfully hard to get to just now. They're restoring the monument to the town square, and the streets are a bit...
She searched for a word.
Addled, in a jumble.
Uh-huh. He'd have to get someone to drive him. He knew he couldn't make the trip alone. He'd call Buck. On second thought, he didn't want to give false hope, and he certainly couldn't ask George, who was just getting established in two jobs.
I'm going down there if I can find someone to... I think it's a bit soon to make the drive myself.
I'll drive you.
Oh, heavens, no. That would be asking...
But you're not asking, she said, clearly excited. I'm offering.
It would be a great privilege to do something for you, Father, who has done so much for me. Now, Helene, when would you wish to leave?
He thought a moment.
Could we leave at once?
Je serai devant votre maison dans 5 minutes.
I beg your pardon?
I'll be there in 5 minutes, Father, 5 minutes.
Thank you, he said. But Helene had already hung up. Uncle Billy Watson stood before the mirrored door of the bathroom medicine cabinet and spoke aloud to his image.
"Well, sir, this feller got a parrot for his birthday, don't you know?"
He glanced at the almanac he was holding, but his trembling hand caused the words to dance a jig. It was enough to give a man a headache, trying to read words that bounced around like a monkey on a mule.
"Hold still," he commanded.
He was surprised to see that his hand obeyed him. He adjusted his glasses, held the almanac closer to the light above the cabinet, and squinted at the next line.
"It was a full-growed parrot, and come with a mean attitude and made a manner of talkin' that was scandalous. Seemed like every other word or two would near about kink a man's hair. Course, the feller tried to change things, don't you know. He was all the time saying polite words, playing soft music on the radio, anything he could think of to try and set a good example. But there wouldn't nothing work."
Uncle Billy laid the almanac on the tank of the commode, squeezed his eyes shut, and repeated by memory what he'd just read aloud. He figured he'd done that part pretty good. He picked up the almanac and adjusted his glasses, which were taped across the nose bridge, where several months ago they had broken in two.
"One day he got so mad, he took that old bird and shook it till its beak rattled. Boys, that fired the parrot up. He went to cussin' the feller ever which way, saying worse of things than he'd been a-sayin'. Well, sir, the feller grabbed that bird up and stuck it in the freezer and slammed the door. Yes, sir. Heard it a-squawkin', a-kickin', a-screamin', and I don't know what all. Then it got real still in there. Feller was scared he'd lost his parrot, so he opened the freezer door, and dad jing, if the parrot didn't step out nice as you please and said, 'I'm mighty sorry if I offended you with my language and all, and I ask your forgiveness, don't you know. I'll sure try to correct my actions from here on out.' The feller was about to ask what caused such a big change when the parrot said, 'About that chicken in there, may I ask what in the world it done?' By Johnny, that ought to work, if he practiced it enough times. He just hoped it would make the preacher laugh. That was the main thing. He'd never seen a man look so low, like he could crawl under a snake's belly wearing a top hat. He'd give a dollar bill to say this joke to Rose Watson, to get somebody else's opinion, but Rose never laughed at his jokes, no, sir, never did. He noted that his right hand had begun to tremble again. He stuck it in his pocket and walked into the hall with his cane in the other hand, singing under his breath. It was the song his mother had taught him as a boy. He often mumbled or sang a few words of Red Wing when he was happy. Driving with Helene Pringle made flying with Omer Cunningham resemble an Altar Guild tea party. He shut his eyes, unable to look. Helene was proceeding down the winding mountain road like a ball from a cannon. If his blood had been as turgid as a river bottom these past weeks, it was now pumping like oil through a derrick. To make things worse, Helene seemed incapable of driving and speaking English at the same time. Worse still, she was precisely the height of Sadie Baxter, and could barely see over the steering wheel.
"I do love these mountain roads. They make me feel so free. Je n'ai jamais de la vie été plus heureuse nulle part ailleurs que je ne le suis ici dans ce montagne. I presume that's true for you also, as you've chosen to live here so many years. Ça, par exemple, regardez le nuage au-dessus de ce pic-là.
Helene, he croaked, could you slow down, just a mite? He emphasized mite, as he certainly didn't want to offend.
Of course, father, but my speedometer reads only 55.
Better take your car in and let Harley have a look. I think we're doing 70. 80 was more like it, but he didn't want to push.
70? But this car has never done 70.
He shut his eyes and prayed.
"What's he look like?" asked the pharmacist.
Father Tim reached for his wallet, as Helene explained.
"Tall, very thin, freckles, red hair, quite dirty."
"Here," said Father Tim, holding out a photo of Dooley. "Something like this." The pharmacist looked disapproving.
"You must be talking about Sammy Barlow. We've caught him trying to stuff his britches with candy, but nobody's ever actually found anything on him."
Father Tim's heart pounded. He looked around for a chair, some place to sit for a moment.
"Where does he live?"
"God only knows. Some place with his old man, who's the worst drunk you'll ever run into. Why would you be looking for this boy? I see you're clergy."
"Yes, well, he's..."
Father Tim paused a moment.
"He's family."
The pharmacist raised his eyebrows.
"You could ask at the pool hall. Go down to the corner, cross the street, and it's on your left."
They bolted from the drugstore, the bell jangling on the door, and went at a trot to the corner, where they waited for the light. His breath came quickly. His head felt lighter than air. "Helene, this could be a dead end, but you need to know how terribly, terribly important it is for us to do what we're doing. Do you pray?"
"I've just begun," she said,
thrilled that this might somehow make things more convenient for him.
"Pray, then. You may have found Dooley's kid brother."
Tears sprang to her eyes.
"Oh," she said, breathless. "Oh!"
"That definitely ain't Sammy Barlow," said the pool hall owner. He took a long drag on the last of his cigarette, dropped it to the cement floor, and stepped on it. "This boy looks like he's living high on the hog." He exhaled a considerable fume of smoke.
"Right. What I'm saying is, does Sammy look like this boy? Is there a strong resemblance?"
"Oh, yeah, I'd say so. What you need to know for?"
"I'd like to contact him."
"Has he come into big money?"
The man cackled. Two other men halted their pool game and listened to the conversation. "Nothing like that. Perhaps you can tell us where he lives."
"I can't tell you that."
"Why not?" He hadn't careened down the mountain with Helene Pringle, risking life and limb, to be put off so easily.
"Because it ain't nobody's business is why not."
"I'm family," he said,
as if that would change everything. The man smirked.
"You're a preacher."
"Preachers have families," said Helene, indignant.
"You might as well go on. I ain't telling you nothing."
The man walked across the room, entered a door marked office, and slammed it behind him. A radio played, drifting randomly between two country stations. One of the pool players walked over and held out his hand.
"How bad you want to know where Sammy lives at?"
"Real bad," said Father Tim.
"Pink Shuford."
"Pink," said Father Tim, shaking hands. "Tim Cavanaugh, and this is Miss Pringle." Helene put her hands behind her back.
"Bonjour."
Father Tim thought he heard a tremor in her voice.
"Named after my great-grandpa, Pinckney."
"A fine old southern name."
"This here's skinhead Bug-Eye Snaggletooth Austin. You can call him Bug for short."
Father Tim nodded toward Bug, who blinked, but didn't return the nod.
"You ever shoot any pool?" asked Pink Shuford.
His left arm was tattooed with a snake, coiled from wrist to elbow.
"Once or twice. I'd appreciate knowing where we can find Sammy."
Pink walked back to the table, hunkered over it with the stick, and made a shot. The balls clicked together and rolled apart. The 7 ball dropped into the corner pocket.
"I reckon you ain't played enough pool to recognize that as a mighty fine shot."
"No, I haven't," said Father Tim.
7 in the corner pocket. Most places I could have won cash money on that shot."
"What will it take for you to tell us where to find Sammy?"
"Well, let's see."
Pink scratched his head and gazed at the ceiling.
"Let me just see now."
The odor of stale tobacco and sour beer permeated the room. A ceiling fan oscillated over their heads. Pink Shuford looked at Father Tim and suddenly grinned.
"How about—"
Bug's cue ball scratched in the side pocket. Pink eyed the table, chalked his cue, bent over the rail, and returned the shot.
8 ball in the corner pocket, eat your heart out," said Pink.
Bug uttered a curse.
"Now," said Pink, "back to business. How about 50 bucks?
Father Tim took out his wallet and examined the billfold. 20, 30, 35, 6, 7, 8. He felt a trickle of sweat along his spine. This whole scenario exuded a palpable darkness. He wanted out of here. Helene was already backing toward the door. 38, said Father Tim.
"Deal."
Pink crossed to him quickly and took the money. He stuffed it in his jeans pocket.
"Follow me and Bug. I'm in the blue Chevy truck out front."
"Perhaps you could just give us directions."
"You ain't going to find it without help."
There was no turning back. We're parked in front of the drugstore.
"A gray Dodge sedan," said Helene, the quaver still in her voice. "How far do you think it might be to where we're going?"
Pink Shuford pulled a lucky strike from a package in his shirt pocket.
"Maybe 10, 12 miles.
He lit the cigarette with a match, inhaled deeply, and grinned at Helene.
"I hope you got good shocks, lady."
Father Tim managed to beat her to the car, and racing to the driver's side, gripped the door handle. "I'll be glad to drive."
"Oh, no, Father. There's something wrong with the brakes. I have to tap them just so, or—"
"Or what?"
"Or they don't work very well. You just get in and relax and leave the driving to me."
"Relax, relax." He took out his handkerchief and wiped his brow, then got in, sat down, and crossed himself. "Surround us with your loving care," he prayed silently. "Protect us from every danger, and bring us in safety to our journey's end. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen." Helene started the car with a roar.
"I'm so glad you're praying," she said happily.
The pickup truck didn't appear to slow down for the bend in the road. Helene gunned the motor, and they careened after it.
"Mon Dieu!" gasped Helene. "What haste they make! Our own speed is 50.
60, he thought, paralyzed with dread. But why worry? Didn't he believe God had a time for everybody? If so, so be it. He was ready. It's just that there were other ways he'd rather go home, like in his sleep, with a smile on his face. He had an awful and hankering thirst. It had come upon him suddenly as they pulled away from the curb in holding. Not only had he left the house without a bottle of water, he realized he'd utterly forgotten his morning insulin shot. Elaine's face looked considerably pinched, not to mention white as a sheet, as his mother would have said.
"Are you all right?"
"It is a very uncomfortable thing to talk about, Father."
"You can talk about it to me." He watched her struggle with some deep truth.
"I would hope to be delicate, but you see..."
They hauled around another curve, and were now barreling down a steep grade on a gravel road, enveloped in a flume of dust kicked up by the truck.
"I desperately need to find a powder room."
He thought she might burst into tears of humiliation. "And I need to find water," he said, equally urgent. It didn't look hopeful. No, indeed. They were in the piney woods, with no habitation in sight. In truth, he hoped they didn't meet another vehicle, as the road was fit for the passage of one car only. What had he gotten them into? He felt a sudden responsibility for Helene Pringle, an innocent bystander. They passed a deserted house trailer.
"There's something else I should tell you," she said. "Something far worse."
"What's that?"
"Our petrol gauge reads half full, but the gauge doesn't work properly. There's really less than a quarter of a tank."
"Aha." Uh-huh.
"We left in such haste that I forgot to look until now, but I'm sure we have enough to get back to town."
Her voice trailed away thinly. "Lord have mercy." "I'm sure," he said, coughing from the dust seeping into the car.
"J'en suis désolé, mon père. Pardonnez-moi. J'espère que je ne nous ai pas attiré des ennuis."
He had no idea what she was saying, but her distress was evident. "We can turn around and go back," he exclaimed, thinking to console her.
"No, no, we must not do that. This is very crucial to your happiness, to dear Dooley's happiness. We must press on and take our chances."
She turned to look at him, beseeching.
"You pray, Father, and I'll drive."
The road was a washboard. He thought his insides might be rearranged in some unrecognizable way, his liver where a kidney had been, his heart in his throat. They followed the blue truck, making a hard left turn onto an unmarked dirt road, scarred with potholes. He heard the exhaust pipe scrape over one rock, then another. This was hardly better than a dry creek bed. He realized suddenly that the truck had disappeared. "Where did they get to?"
"I don't know," she said, bewildered. "But we'll catch them."
He clapped a hand over his eyes and held on for dear life. He didn't want to admit it, even to himself, but minutes later he was greatly relieved to find that the truck had indeed disappeared. Helene slowed down and stopped for a moment, shaken. He had the odd feeling they'd gotten off light with a $38 joyride. The fatigue was like nothing he'd ever experienced. It was all the exhaustion and despair of the last weeks rolled into a single agony. He supposed he'd have to turn himself into an institution of some sort. He could not be trusted to care for himself. Perhaps there was a kind of death wish in him that he'd never routed out, that he'd held back from God and never let him touch. On their way home, they had stopped to go to the restroom, get gas, and take nourishment. He sat in the car at the service station like an invalid, while Helene pumped gas, bought drinks and two bags of Fritos, and ministered to his pathetic needs. It was desperately humiliating, but he could do nothing about it. As they sped up the mountain, he guzzled bottled water and feebly consumed the Fritos. He came into his kitchen, out of breath and dazed, and reached for the countertop of the island. As the wave of fatigue rolled over him, he felt like a sinking swimmer whose foot had just touched an undertow. He inhaled deeply
and shook his head, panicked. Then it passed, and he was safe again, holding on to the countertop and looking into the eyes of his dog. He led Barnabas into the yard without a leash, something he rarely did, and thanked God that his faithful companion obeyed his master's every command. Now he could administer his evening shot and drag himself to bed. That's all he wanted. Nothing more. Nothing. He was sleeping when the phone rang. He fumbled it to his ear. Hello? Ah, Timothy. So glad you're there. It's Edith. Edith? Was this a dream? When we spoke last evening, I said I ought to thank you, and then, silly me, I forgot to actually do it. So thank you, Timothy, thank you. God uses everything for good, don't you think? But I mustn't keep you. Blessings to you and Cynthia and that dear boy you took in. Toodles! He was dumbfounded all over again, but more than that, he felt molested, plain and simple. Why would Edith Mallory never leave him alone? Why did she endlessly insinuate herself into his life? He hated this business of phoning him up like some old school chum, and fervently hoped it would never happen again. Perhaps it wouldn't. She had thanked him, after all, for whatever aberrant reason she might have had, and that should be enough. He hoped to God it would be enough. The talk with Cynthia hadn't gone well. She'd heard his fatigue and wanted to know everything. But he'd been afraid to tell her everything. He knew that hiding the raw details from his wife, or any wife, did not bode well for future outcomes. But he couldn't explain it all. It was too exhausting, too complicated, too... He thought the whole afternoon vaguely dreamlike, as if it had never happened. He'd been to another world with the intent of accomplishing a grand mission, and had come home humbled and defeated. Why even speak of it? At the foot of the bed, Barnabas scratched furiously, causing the mattress to throb like a great, arrhythmic heartbeat. Still awake at 3 in the morning, Father Tim lay in the dark room and looked out the window to darkness. The heavens were overcast, obscuring a nearly full moon, and the street lamp had been knocked winding 2 weeks ago by a careless driver. Who was to say that Cynthia wouldn't give up on him? In truth, he was wearing down while she was gearing up. How long could a bright, successful, beautiful woman be patient with a man who had no passion in him anywhere? His wife was all about passion, passion for whatever she was doing, for whatever lay ahead. At the beginning, she'd declared him charming and romantic. Perhaps now she was changing her mind. But he couldn't bear such thoughts. It was blasphemy to think these vile things. Are you there, Lord? Sometimes I can't sense your presence. I have to go on faith alone. You want us to walk by faith. You tell us so. Don't we go on faith that the sun will set, the moon will rise, our breath will come in and go out again, our hearts will beat? Give me faith, Lord, to know your presence as surely as I know the beating of my own heart. I've felt so far from you. He remembered Miss Sadie's story of falling into the abandoned well, of her terror as she cried out, unheard in the dark summer night, and unable to move. She said she'd known for the first time the deep meaning of the prayers she had learned by rote. It was the darkness, Miss Sadie had told him. That was the worst. The tears were hot on his face. His own life seemed overwhelmed by darkness these last weeks. There had been the bright and shining possibility, then had come the crushing darkness. Something flickered in his memory. "Songbirds," he whispered.
Songbirds, yes, are taught to sing in the dark.
That was a line from Oswald Chambers, from the book he'd kept by his bedside for many years. But he couldn't bear switching on the lamp. His eyes had been feeling weak and even painful. He turned on his side and opened the drawer of the nightstand and took out the flashlight. Then he pulled Cynthia's pillow atop his own and shone the flashlight on the open book. He thumbed through the worn and familiar pages. There, page 45, the reading for February 14th. At times, God puts us through the discipline of darkness to teach us to heed him. Songbirds are taught to sing in the dark, and we are put into the shadow of God's hand until we learn to hear him. Watch where God puts you into darkness, and when you are there, keep your mouth shut. Are you in the dark just now in your circumstances, or in your life with God? Then remain quiet. When you are in the dark, listen, and God will give you a very precious message for someone else when you get into the light. The flashlight slid onto the bed beside him as he fell asleep, but his hand resolutely gripped the book until dawn.
Chapter 12, Where the Heart Is. Uncle Billy Watson decided he was fed up with trying to learn jokes from a book. A man had to study out a little bitty part in print as fine as frog hair, then close his eyes and say it out loud till he got it right, then study out the next dad-blame part, and so on, till the whole works was so mixed up in his head he didn't hardly know himself if it was funny. He hadn't laughed one time over that parrot joke, so why did he think he could get the preacher to laugh?
"Where are you headed?" demanded his wife. "Out to my dad Jing garden," he said, stomping to the door. "This soup's cooked and ready to eat." "It's too hot for soup," he said, mad as a hornet about things in general. "A man oughtn't to have to eat soup when the weather's 90 degrees in the shade. A man ought to eat what's offered and be glad to get it."
He thought Rose Watson was the meanest-looking woman he ever laid eyes on, the way she crossed her arms and glared down on him like he was 2 feet tall. He sometimes figured there wasn't nothing at all wrong with his wife. She was smart as a whip and twice as tough. Her sickness was just something she used to get attention and worry a man to death.
"No rest for the wicked, and the righteous don't need none," he said under his breath.
He let the screen door slam behind him, even if slamming doors wasn't allowed in his house, and went down the back steps with his cane. For all he cared, she could holler at him till she was blue in the face. He was going out to his little patch and set in a chair and watch his sprouts grow. He'd make up his own joke, by Johnny. A man who'd lived 80-some years ought to have enough dad blame sense to make up his own joke. They lay facing each other in bed. The moon had risen, bright and full, illuminating the room. "It was good for you to get away," he said, tracing the outline of her ear with his fingertips. "Yes, it was. But it's better for me to be home." "Do you really mean it?" "I really mean it." He kissed her, lingering. "I think you're glad I'm home."
"Amen." She smiled.
"Home is where the heart is."
She put her palm against his cheek and kissed him back. He felt the slow, steady tide rising in him. He wasn't as old and feeble as he'd thought. No, indeed. He wasn't old and feeble at all.
Hope Winchester sat on the stool behind the cash register at Happy Endings, not daring to lift her eyes from the book she was reading.
She couldn't make heads nor tails of the words. They seemed to mush together in a kind of typographical quagmire. What a snare she'd gotten herself into. She was exerting every effort to appear absorbed in Jim the Boy, which the New York Times had raved over, but her mind was riveted on the mailroom. It was nearly unbearable that the door to the mailroom, just a few feet from the register, was partially open. Occasionally, she saw him walk to the stacks and take a book from the shelf. She thought his hands mesmerizing, long, tapered fingers that seemed to hold things with sensitivity and purpose. She tried to forget that he'd used those same fingers to unscrew the oil pan from a car and steal a friend's jewels, which, as it turned out, had been stolen from a British museum. But that was over. That was past. He had suffered his punishment, and was nice as anything, and very serious and kind, and loved books as much as she did. She thought she might have borne his nearness with more equanimity if he had not loved books, or if he were not so very handsome. She had never been around handsome men, and the fact that one was working in the next room, and speaking her name, and occasionally bringing her coffee in the mornings was, she tried to find words for what it was. It was something like painful, even excruciating, to have him so near, and to feel such an avalanche of emotion, and be completely unable to laugh and talk and go about one's life normally, instead of sitting on a stool, frozen with longing and fear and pretense, trying to read words that would not penetrate her brain. "Miss Winchester?" George Gaynor stood at the open door, only feet away, smiling. He was wearing a denim shirt, the color of his eyes. She could barely speak.
"Yes?"
"I wonder if you would show me how to enter this order. It's different from all the others." She wanted to die on the spot and get it over with, and not suffer so cruelly. "Of course," she said, slipping off the stool. The book crashed to the floor, and she stooped to pick it up. She looked at him as she laid it on the counter, and saw that he was smiling. "You know how things have gone the past couple of years," he told Buck on the phone. "We've had a lot of disappointments. Maybe we shouldn't say anything yet to Pauline and the kids, or to Dooley. But Sammy is in holding." He heard the sharp intake of breath. "What are the circumstances?" "He's living with his father. I don't know where. I had someone drive me down the mountain, and we were led on a wild goose chase." "I'll stop by tomorrow night on my way home, if that's all right. I've got to take Pooh and Jesse to a ball game tonight," I promised.
"I have a big event planned tomorrow night. How about in the morning? Maybe the grill. Could you be there at, say, 8:30?
"I'll be there," said Buck. For a man who had once scared the living daylights out of him, not to mention made him plenty mad, Buck Leeper now offered a kind of consolation. If there was anybody he'd want in his corner when facing down Clyde Barlow, it was Buck Leeper. He should tell his wife the news about Sammy, but it took too much energy to start at the beginning and explain everything. He would wait. He was feeling stronger today than in a very long time, but every activity cost him dearly in strength, bringing in the paper, talking to Harley, walking his dog to the corner, the slightest thing. He would tell her after he and Buck had talked, when they had put together a plan. After all, she was good with plans. He could run it by her and get her input. That had always proved to be a good thing.
"Tim, it's your brother in the Lord."
"Bill,
you'll never guess what's happened."
"No, sir, I couldn't. What is it?"
The Lord has sent me a dog.
You don't mean it.
He was mighty quick about it. I wasn't looking for one so soon. But this is it. This is the one. I want you to see him, Tim. He's a laugh a minute. Are you getting out yet?
I got out for a haircut and a little drive. I want to come up for a visit. When would be a good time?
Any time is a good time. Just come on.
Have you named him?
Buddy.
Buddy. Good name. I'm sure he'll live up to it.
He walks sideways.
That takes some doing. What age do you think?
5, maybe 6 years old. One of the congregation found him in a ditch. No tags. Bones sticking out. I talked to Sparky about it last night. Sparky says it's okay. Said to let him have...
Bill's voice broke, but only for a moment.
To let him have his bed over in the corner of our bedroom.
I'm thrilled for you, Bill.
Are you doing all right?
God is faithful. I'm coming along, said Father Tim. How about you, my friend?
Can't complain.
Well, if you can't complain, nobody can.
Why don't I bring you and Rachel some fruit tarts?
No, sir. Hoppy's got me off sugar.
He's got everybody off sugar. These deals are sugar-free.
Bring 'em on, then, brother, said Bill Sprouse, laughing.
Father Tim felt the weight lifting from his shoulders, moving off his chest. Bill Sprouse had a dog. Bill Sprouse was laughing. God was faithful indeed. When he took the tarts up the hill tomorrow, he'd throw in a box of dog treats. He didn't think he'd ever driven to the grill before. He'd always walked, no matter what the weather. Feeling like one of the modern-day common horde, he backed the Mustang out of the garage in order to drive 2 blocks. He was saving the energy it would take to walk, saving it for her.
"I ain't believing my eyes." Percy wiped his hands on the towel he kept tucked in his belt and trotted to the rear booth.
"I thought you'd dropped off of the face of the earth."
"Back again and better than ever. It's great to see you, Buddy Rowe. Where's Velma?"
"In the restroom, taking curlers out of her hair."
"Uh-huh.
I ain't poached an egg since the last time you was in here."
"We'll see if you've lost your touch. I'll have 2 poached on whole wheat, the usual." He slid his coffee cup to Percy, who filled it.
"Your trouble," said Percy, feigning aggravation but clearly pleased. "Want you a little bacon on the side? A dish of grits?"
"Cantaloupe. I've been craving a good cantaloupe."
"Sliced or cubed?"
"I've got a choice."
"Nah, I was just kidding. All we got is sliced."
"All I want is sliced," said Father Tim, grinning.
"I got something in the back with your name on it. Come in yesterday, UPS.
"Right. I'll get it before I go. Thought I'd hang with Mule and J.C. a while, then meet Buck Leeper here around 8:30.
"Yeah, well, the Turkey Club ain't been the same with you gone."
"The Turkey Club?"
"That's Velma's name for the regulars in the rear booth."
"Descriptive.
So, what's the latest scandal and gossip? What have I missed?"
J.C. slid into the booth with his bulging, unzippered briefcase.
"All scandal and gossip has been duly recorded in the Mitford Muse. If I didn't report it, it didn't happen."
The editor shoved a copy of the newspaper across the table.
"Hot off the press. All the news that's fit to print. You heard it here first. That'll be 50 cents.
50 cents? Said Father Tim.
"Paper's gone up. Ink's gone up. Distribution's gone up."
Percy filled J.C.'s cup, frowning.
"Quality's gone down."
"A man has to make a living," said J.C.
He dragged a rumpled handkerchief from his jacket pocket, unfurled it, and mopped his brow.
10 cents worth of news for half a dollar is what that deal is." "While you're preaching," snapped J.C., "let me have a quarter's worth of sausage biscuit for a dollar, with a 25-cent side of hash browns for $1.75."
"Turkey," muttered Percy, legging it to the grill. "So look at the front page," said J.C.
There was his wife, nearly large as life, with a shot of the Davant medal used as an inset. The picture definitely did not do her justice. No, indeed. Heads would roll at her publishing house for sending out this particular photo.
"Read the headline," said J.C. "I wrote that. I always write the big stuff. I don't farm out the big stuff."
Prestigious Davant Metal bestowed on local author.
"I had trouble with the headline," confessed the editor.
"No kidding."
"Yeah, I didn't know whether to say local or world famous. I thought local was more..."
"Sells more papers," said Father Tim, trying to be helpful.
"Then I thought bestowed kind of a big word for a small-town newspaper."
"Right.
But I figured that learning a new word could be educational."
"Good thinking. Why should he be the one to point out the spelling in the much-talked-about headline?"
"Look it, I put in there about the invitation for her to tour the country on that literacy deal."
It was in the letter her publisher sent down.
"Very thorough story. But she won't be going on the tour." "Let me slide in here and drink a little coffee before the roof caves in."
Mule Skinner thumped down beside Father Tim.
"Why is the roof caving in?" asked J.C. "Because the father's here, blockhead."
"Oh," said J.C. Though he'd been out of the picture for only a few weeks, Father Tim felt it might have been a few years. These guys looked different somehow. It would take a while for the new to wear off and the old to kick in again.
"So what's it going to be?"
Percy called from the grill, where he was working bacon, sausage, and hash browns.
"The usual," said Mule.
"What the dickens is that?"
Percy wanted to know.
"You ain't ordered the same thing twice in 20 years.
"Give me a break. Just last week I ordered eggs over light twice in a row."
"So that's your order, eggs over light?"
"I didn't say that was my order. I said..."
Velma blew out of the restroom.
"Let me get in here. I'll yank his order out of him."
J.C. put his head in his hands.
"Just once, man. Heaven knows. Just once." "Just once what?"
"Just once. Order and get it over with."
"Right,"
said Velma, gripping her order pad.
"And make it snappy."
"Over light or not?" demanded J.C.
"Over light, for Pete's sake. White toast, hold the butter, grape jelly, orange juice, hash browns."
There was a stunned silence.
"There, dadgummit!"
Mule looked triumphant.
"I hope you all are satisfied."
"I can't believe it," said Velma. "This'll be one for the history books. Now what was it you said after orange juice?"
Mule shrugged. "I don't know."
"You don't know what you said?"
"I wasn't listening." "Hash browns," said J.C. "He said hash browns." "Yeah, but maybe I should have grits."
"With butter."
"Why not? Butter on the grits, but no butter on the toast."
"Bring him hash browns," said J.C.
Velma gazed briefly at the ceiling, ripped the order off the pad, stuck it on the spindle at the counter, and stumped to the next booth.
"Man," said J.C., mopping his face.
Mule turned to Father Tim and grinned broadly.
"So, Buddy Rowe, welcome back."
"Thanks. Glad to be back. Looks like nothing's changed."
Same old," said Mule.
Father Tim was certain that Mule had glanced at him in an odd way. In truth, he might as well take the bull by the horns and deal straight up with what people were thinking about the accident. His heart hammered as he asked, not really wanting to know.
"So what are you thinking?"
"Thinking?" asked Mule. I'm not thinking anything.
Par for the course, said J.C. Father Tim smelled the bacon frying. He heard the rattle of the window air conditioner. He saw Percy slicing the cantaloupe. He wedged his back into the corner of the booth, as he'd done for nearly 2 decades. The place where the green, painted wood converged felt a lot like home.
Maybe we should turn it over to the authorities. Let social services be the go-between.
With 3 marriages and a drinking problem, I've had all the go-between I can choke down, said Buck. Sometimes I think we should let sleeping dogs lie. Jessie was a baby when the kids were split up. She doesn't remember Sammy or Kenny. And Pooh hardly remembers them either. Things are settled with us, running pretty smooth.
Buck looked at the tabletop, then at Father Tim.
But there's no way we can't try and pull this family back together. No way.
If it all works out, you'd want Sammy to live with you?
We'd want to give him the option, said Buck.
The boy could have serious behavior problems.
We understand that. It would mean a lot just to know he's all right. And if he wants to live with us, if we could get it through the courts, we'll give it our best shot.
When I went to holding the other day,